Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, October 20th, 2012. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is Two Kingdoms of Terror. Now, I do presume you know that refers to the kingdom of the in Saudi Arabia and the kingdom in the British Isles. That is, I'm referring literally to the kind of royal syndicate currently in power in these respective places. I'm certainly not referring to the residents of the Arabian Peninsula or the British Isles. And speaking of terror, what we're talking about is the fact that these networks I'm just referring to are perpetrating the kinds of terrorist acts, fomenting war, other destabilizations that constitute what you can call 9/11 take two. They were the very same behind 9/11 in the 2001 September 11, and the same process is underway today. Now, I'll get to say more about that in a minute, but I'd very much like to introduce our two guests who are going to be discussing this today. Speaking to us long distance from Scandinavia, we are glad to welcome Hussein Askari. Welcome, Hussein.
Thank you very much, Marcia.
And Hussein is back. This is a repeat for him several times in recent years. He is our editor, Arab language editor for Executive Intelligence Review and for EIR Online. And so we're glad to have you here in this kind of special moment of strategic developments. And here with me in the studio, I'm glad to welcome our editor, New Delhi Desk. That is to say, we're talking about India for the EIR Online, Ramtanu Maitra. Welcome, Tanu.
Thank you, Marcia. Glad to be here.
So what I want to say, I have kind of three brief points, and then we'll ask Hussein to start with describing the situation, is that you know that today, October 20, is the date on which a year ago Muammar Gaddafi in Libya was murdered while in captivity, along with over 60 others of his convoy or grouping there. That is to say, they were all captive, but they were murdered. Now, this is one instance, but it's indicative of not just a low point in what the United States foreign policy has come down to, the kind of depravity involved of the Obama White House that self-congratulates itself for this, for killing bin Laden, for drone attacks that kill hundreds and hundreds of, in fact, thousands of citizens that have nothing to do perhaps with the target. It's not just that, but the in itself, those reprehensible instances, but the collaboration involved with the networks, the Saudi-British networks, whose intent is to undermine the nations, whose intent is to perpetrate strife and, in fact, bluff or genuinely start conditions for full warfare. What all this amounts to is we're already in a process of war. It's not as if one day someone announces, okay, war is going to start tomorrow, get ready. It's underway. And that's what today's briefing, it amounts to, by these two expert guests, is about, on what's involved in that. And we're doing that. We are asking them to speak about this from the point of view of intervening in history, that we should finally bring this to an end. And what I want to stress about that is the Executive Intelligence Review, EIR Online, has a new report out, a special report, which came not only is available electronically, but also is printed in hard copy for 125 pages. Issue date is October 2012, and thousands came from the literally off the presses yesterday. And it's something you should have. The title is Obama's War on America, 9/11-2. It has documentation, it has illustrations, but it also has reprinting in hard copy, in this case, of key articles, some of the last 20 years, especially of recent years, though, of, as I say, documenting these networks we're now talking about, that's an immediate threat to the planet, not just to the United States, to somewhere else. And the third, well, the point I'm making about this is the reason we've rushed this out is the election now is in, what, 16 days. And this is a key shift point historically, not just some other election. I hope most of you listening today, or all of you, have had a chance by now, or will soon take it, to hear the third of Mr. Lyndon LaRouche's Friday Project International webcast. He gave one October 19th in the evening. That's the third in a series. He'll do it again two times before the election. And last night, October 19th, was called Countdown to Obama's Removal. Because that's the point. We want to look to the future without Obama in office. That does not mean we're home free, paradise is ahead. No. It means we have the opportunity to roll back the dangers and active threats now in play around the world. Now, with that, I'll just say one more thing. Oh, by the way, I'm going to give the number now. Those of you listening, some of you listen on a phone message line, some of you are online live. You can get this report, Obama's War on America, 9/11-2. You can order it online, but you can also phone. Sometimes it's easier, including if you're online, phone 800-278-3135. That's the EIR's toll-free number in the U.S. It goes to their national center, 800-278-3135. And you can get many reports and give them to the people that you think are activate and make a difference. You'll want to have it yourself. The cover price is $100. Call that number and dicker if you want to and get 10 reports and they'll give you a discount. But do it. Whatever it is, whatever you want to do, I encourage you. 800-278-3135. Now with that, what I want to just end my remarks with is just a reference to what you've seen or what's coming out about the particulars about the September 11, 2012 attack in Benghazi, where the U.S. ambassador to Libya was killed and three other Americans. But in fact, what you've seen since then is the way plenty came out about the creation of vulnerability for that kind of thing happening due to the Obama White House following London orders and just saying, oh, Al-Qaeda and terrorism is being rolled back, Libya is getting on its feet, it's in transition to real statehood, and then following that, the Obama White House, through Ambassador Susan Rice to the United Nations and through Obama himself, for days and days kept repeating the only reason these murders and this assault came on the U.S. mission in Benghazi was because it was a spontaneous reaction among people on the streets to an insulting video made months ago. All of these lies. As Mr. LaRouche used the expression once, this is just homicidal hypocrisy on the part of Obama. And we don't need to, we can't do or do not have to go into the particulars of that in this hour, but they are out there everywhere. There will be a debate, you know, in foreign policy between Obama and Romney on the 23rd. That will be Monday evening, the third of the three debates. Who knows what will be said or not, but it's out there. It's truth that this situation is full of lies and deliberate following by the White House of orders by controllers of terrorist networks, which are the British and the Saudis. And so I just want to situate our discussion by quoting our editors of the new report, Obama's War on America, 9/11-2, when they said on September 11, 2012 in Benghazi, Libya, something happened that can and must be used to finally stop not only Obama, but the entire British-Saudi apparatus from carrying out their hideous plans. While the full details are still coming out, the British-Saudi-Obama game itself is exposed. A new opportunity has been offered, but it's perhaps the last opportunity for the patriotic leadership of the United States to mobilize itself, along with the LaRouche movement, to destabilize the British plans by removing Barack Obama from office. So that was the intent in the report, and with that, I'd like to just turn the discussion over to Hussein Asghari, especially in terms of, if you would, give us some idea of the sweep of what Mr. LaRouche and we are here calling the 9/11-2 patterns of terrorism, of strife, of sectarianism, as you've often forewarned about, and even what Al-Qaeda, making that reference, is or isn't right now across this entire region. Hussein.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the British Kingdom, they are actually inseparable. They are the one entity. I mean, Saudi Arabia, from its conception, almost more than a century ago, was a British project. And also, the whole domination of the so-called Saudi and other sheikhdoms in the region coincided with the British move into the Indian Ocean and India already in the 18th century, but then later became more and more involved in running the affairs of these countries, and all these small countries in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia were created physically and practically by the British. Now, the thing is, what we have had, although there is a long history of the British Empire's operations in Asia and in the Southwest Asia, that since the murder of Gaddafi last October, we were put on a trajectory towards actually a global conflict in which we are now face-to-face, that the United States, NATO, the British are face-to-face now with Russia and China right in Syria, in the same region where the Saudis and the British and the Obama administration are very active to support a bloody war there, which could expand beyond Syria into the whole of Eurasia and get us into a direct conflict with Russia. As Mr. LaRouche has warned, that kind of conflict is not going to be irregular warfare as we saw in Afghanistan in the 80s, but it's going to be thermonuclear war. And the real issue here is with the British intention, the British Empire intention, or the Anglo-Saudi Empire, we can call it, is to destroy the idea of the sovereign nation state. And that includes all nations, and not only in the region, but including the United States and Europe. And there are different methods that are being used to destroy this principle of national sovereignty. In Europe, we see it here today in the banking and financial crisis, whereby a super European state is being established, or the intention is to establish it. In the United States, is to turn the United States from a sovereign republic into an empire, which would be a subsidiary of the British Empire. So that's really the issue. When in October last year, the Russia and China vetoed UN Security Council resolution for intervention in Syria, what they were discussing is this exactly the principle of national sovereignty, that this is the last front line we have before we got into a world war. And that has to be protected and preserved. So this is the story is, and Saudi Arabia and its allies now, Qatar or Turkey right now, are actively involved in, you know, promoting this option for the British Empire, because they have the hands-on control in the region, and they are using this religious aspect, which is really the a very, very dirty and nasty way of running warfare, because we are faced with actually religious warfare in the whole region. It did not start with the murder of Gaddafi, but since the so-called Arab Spring, which was militarized by the Obama administration and NATO and the British and their allies, we have turned the whole thing from a protest against the injustice, economic injustice, into turning the whole Southwest Asia, North Africa region into fanatic religious states, with the so-called Salafi and Wahhabis taking over with money and weapons in the region. So this has been a project in progress, actually, long time. As I said, since the British got into the Indian Ocean, but in practically the whole Saudi kingdom which is, unfortunately, I have to say, it's not really a state. It's some sort of a company. It's like the British East India, It was not an English government, or it was a company or a financial economic enterprise which had armies and intelligence organs and used the people in England and the colonies as the cannon fodder and the tool to run the policies for the British oligarchy and empire. Unfortunately, it created a monster in its own image, which is Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, who are absolute monarchies. There are no elections, there are no real human rights for people, and it's these countries are being run, and Saudi Arabia is a perfect example, by tribal alliances, intermarriages, and control of religion, which is the so-called Wahhabi sect or cult. It's not really a doctrine of Islam, it's a cult, which was established in 1744 when this Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, the founder of the cult, made a political alliance with the Muhammad ibn Saud, who's the great-great-grandfather of the current king. And they established a political entity, but what they were actually in the area of Dar'iyya, in the eastern Arab peninsula, these were bandits who were attacking other tribes and looting them. They were attacking and looting pilgrims who were coming from Iraq, from the other areas in the Ottoman Empire, and looting and raping. And so they were a bunch of bandits who expanded their power through their brutality, but also with British support. And by 1818, they became so powerful that they threatened actually the Ottoman Empire, and they sent the Ottomans sent this son of Muhammad Ali Pasha from Egypt, and you know, he almost finished the Al Saud Wahhabi alliance, and the Al Saud were sent into exile. But in 1902, they had come back there, and the British already had established their the whole Gulf region as their colonies in Kuwait, what is today's Kuwait, the Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and so on, Yemen, Aden, and they had established themselves on the ground. But in 1902, when the Al Saud family came back from exile, they entered an alliance and signed agreements with the British Empire to get both financial support and weapons to recapture the areas which were under their control. And during World War One, as the British entered a war with the Ottoman Empire, the Al Saud family and the Wahhabis became a key factor in the fight against the Ottomans. And in that process, the Al Saud and their tribes and the Wahhabis, they got control of most of the Eastern Arab Peninsula. And then by 1925, still under the control of British army officers, including one called William Shakespeare. Unfortunately, it has the same name as William Shakespeare, but also Sir John Filby, who was the advisor to King Abdulaziz Al Saud. And they captured the western part of Arabia called Al Hijaz, which was under the another of the British allies, the Sharif Hussein family. Sharif Hussein was sent in exile, and then by 1932, the Saudi king, or the Abdulaziz Al Saud, he established himself as king over Saudi Arabia. And this is, I think, to my knowledge, the only country in the world which is named after the king. So Saudi Arabia is the Al Saud family's own enterprise, which is a real tragedy. I mean, because, I mean, in Saudi Arabia, there are people. It's not that the case that there are no people in Saudi Arabia who cannot govern themselves and establish a modern state. The problem is that the alliance with the British Empire has established the Al Saud family and the Wahhabi cult as the main, you know, power in the country. And they have been supported, and especially with the discovery of oil in 1938, the resources, the Saudi Arabia turned from just merely a strategic asset into an economic, financial strategic asset in the whole British Empire's world order, especially after World War II. And the oil money was used and has been used and still used four British operations of destabilization. The most famous one of them was the Afghan war, where the so-called jihadists in Afghanistan were supported with Saudi and other Arab money and arms and intelligence from the British and the United States different organs to start the war against the Soviets. But even before that, after the war, World War II, you had nationalist movements in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, in North Africa. These were nationalist movements against imperialism. So the British, actually, who were dominating most of these countries, the colonialists, and the puppets they had put there after the World War II as their, you know, to run the countries, were threatened by the nationalist movement. What the Saudi role was, is, and the so-called Islamist movement, is to tarnish all the nationalist movements as communist, godless, people. And just to undermine the nationalist movements in these regions and the whole idea of establishing modern nation states. And by 1968, actually the Saudis were involved in many coup attempts in Syria and against Gamal Abdel Nasser, and also their support for the Muslim Brotherhood to destabilize Gamal Abdel Nasser all the way from 1952 to his death in 67. So this whole operation to create the so-called religious alternative, a so-called pan-Islamist movement or pan-Islamist entity as a replacement for the nation states and nationalist movements and these anti-imperialist nationalist movements was spearheaded by the Saudis, especially from 1968 when other British puppets in the region, the so-called extremist and the Zionist movement, they set fire to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And since then we have had this whole situation where the political military conflicts were turned into religious conflicts. And the Saudis sitting on the large amount of financial resources, intelligence and military backing from the British and later the United States, and their religious control, because in Saudi Arabia you have Mecca and Medina, to which tens of millions of people go to pilgrimage from all over the world. So the Saudis have been using their position in both religious and economic position there to spread this so-called Wahhabi Salafi rigid teachings, which are actually a threat to other Islamic established sects. Not only we have the classical picture that this is which Cheney was pushing during the Bush Jr. administration, that to create a so-called Sunni alliance against the Shia alliance, the Shia being Iraq, Iran, and Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Sunnis being the other Arab countries. But it's not really true, because the Wahhabis are a threat to the other Sunni sects too. So, but because of the geopolitics, they say we support the Sunni movements in Syria and Iraq against the Shia influence and Iran. But at the end, they would be threatening the other Sunni sects like the Maliki, Hanafi, Shafi'i, and Hanbali, who are dominant in Iraq and Turkey and Syria and Egypt and so on. So there's a false picture that there's a Sunni-Shia conflict. That's not really the issue. The issue is that the Saudis and the British behind them have pushing this sectarian conflict in the region, but under the pretext of this so-called that they represent the Sunnis. But even the Sunnis are totally scared from the Wahhabi influence in these countries. And it's spreading like wildfire all over North Africa, even in Egypt. It's ironically, they are in conflict now with even the Muslim Brotherhood, because they don't regard the Muslim Brotherhood as pure, following the pure teachings of the so-called Salaf, the original, what they think is the original Islamic way of, worshiping and living. But it has very little to do, really, with the original of Islam. And there are many people in the Muslim countries and Sunnis who are now warning against this Salafi Wahhabi invasion in these countries. And they understand it as part of an imperial force. Now, what we have also, on the other hand, is the Wahhabi Salafi movement, which is the basic ingredient in the creation of the so-called terrorist groups, so-called Islamist terrorist groups, is like the Al-Qaeda and their offshoots, which started in Afghanistan with the indoctrination of these people with the Wahhabi cult thoughts. Is it spreading all the way to the borders of Russia and China in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, and in western part of China? They're trying to increase their influence, and that way use these Wahhabi and Salafi militant groups as a tool against Russia and China to destabilize these two countries. I mean, EIR, and I think recommend that this report should be read by everyone who's interested about solving the question of terrorism, that EIR has had actually the record on this thing, both the history but also practically who is who and who is running what. There are no so-called private terrorist groups. Al-Qaeda was a Saudi-British creation. It was run by the British. Certain periods you have, you know, differences between them, but at the end, they cannot survive without the financial support, weapons, intelligence, and even protection, but also drug money, which is being laundered in the Gulf countries. So there are no so-called, like Obama wants to bomb some groups in Libya. The people who killed Ambassador Stevens, these are not a small group, or not even a large separate group. These are all part of the whole Anglo-Saudi army, which is now being run as an ultra-national force. It's like the, you know, force of globalization, economic globalization. You have the multinational companies. Now you have the multinational terrorist groups who can run over borders of sovereign nations. And that's really the issue with the so-called Islamist terrorist groups. They are being run as an international army by the Anglo-Saudis to destroy nation states and terrorize populations to go to the side of the Saudi Wahhabi cult. So that's where we have the danger, is the abolishing of the principle of national sovereignty, creating religious war situation all over Eurasia and Africa. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, these Wahhabis are active right now, and which will put us into a direct confrontation with Russia and China, a global conflict. So that's really the issue, and time is running out, actually, for these countries, because this religious fanaticism, which is spreading all over the area, would be very, very difficult to wind back and to go back to a time when people were thinking about being citizens in modern secular nation states, where, in any case, religious practice and religious rights are protected. But these are modern nations, not religious states. And maybe they, like the Turkish government now, they might maybe believe or dreaming of the Ottoman religious empire and to establish empires across borders with these religious fanatic beliefs structure. So that's really a very, very big danger to both the world, but also to the societies there, who can make great contributions to the world, both economically, culturally, and so on. But now these countries are being destroyed. So that's really the has been the intention of the British Empire by supporting and creating and supporting the Saudi kingdom.
Yes, that's the sweep, all right. I think historically, present day, and while you didn't have to go into the particulars, the immediate particulars bearing on bringing off the original 2001 September 11th attack in the United States and the World Trade Center in Pennsylvania and the Pentagon. And I'll just throw in here that everyone should recall that the commission that studied how the 9/11, who was behind 9/11 and how it came about, having to do with senators and others, has a section in it that Obama will not release, before him, Cheney and Bush would not release it. 28 pages. The former senator from Florida, I think, Nelson, has called for this to be released. He knows what's in it. And this is the kind of thing you're just describing that we presume is there. We're told it's there. And Obama said in 2009, a month after he was inaugurated, he told some of the families connected to those 3,000 people killed in New York City, I will see that it's released. He has seen that it's even more tightly locked up. So all of everything you just described, the nature of what you described is horrendous and places it in history, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That in terms of what the British Empire did in India, but what this is, we have quite a task to turn this back, but it again focuses on people should unelect Obama. We should have got him out of office due to impeachment or coercion even before now. But Tanu, you may want to say something on any aspect of this, and we can follow through.
Well, what I notice is that the British saw the thing that Hussein Ashkari described as what happened to the centuries. However, one thing that really has created this enormous threat that exists today is definitely not starts with 9/11. 9/11 is a manifestation of that. The real problem started when the Soviets came into Afghanistan, and then the entire anti-Soviet forces in the world, that included everybody who is not considered as communist, and all the religious fanatics, the democracy lovers, people who believed in sovereign nation state and all that kind of stuff. Everybody came together and started developing armed terrorists in Afghanistan in order to defuse the Soviet Union. And that was done. But once that was done, that was over by 1989, over a 10-year period, enormous amount of money, enormous amount of arms training were given. And the whole area was in this process, was sort of compromised, because anybody who wants to prevent the Red Army moving in to the Arabian Sea or eastward were eager to help them. So in 1989, when it was over, then you have this hundreds of thousands of these terrorists who have been created, maybe not hundreds of thousands, but thousands of terrorists that were created, were now available at a very cheap price, because they have nothing, nowhere to go. So they were lingering around Afghanistan. Most of the countries like Algeria, Morocco, and others, Saudis and other Gulf countries, were not interested to take these people back. They had given them, but they don't want to take them back, because these monarchies in Arabia are extremely fragile. They're run by families, and they run ruthlessly and are suppressing the population. Often they take the sectarian line, often they take the other lines. But nonetheless, the basic objective is for these small families to rule over the Arabia. So they didn't want to take them back, because they know that these people can be extremely dangerous and can turn around, and they can unseat them in no time. So the British at that point in time picked them up, a lot of them, and they had their projects all set up. One of the projects was, of course, to get rid of Muammar Gaddafi. Gaddafi was independent. In many ways, Gaddafi had his flaws, but like everybody else, he was very stable at that point in time, was making a lot of money and distributing a lot of money to his people. And despite the tribal tensions that existed, the general conditions in Libya was, living condition in Libya, was much superior on average than it is in Saudi Arabia today. But they had oil. Libya has a lot of oil. And the British wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. They brought in a lot of these terrorists in. And Osama bin Laden, by that time, by 1989, was already a wealthy merchant whose family has is one of the top business, not only construction firm, but I think the one of the top companies in Saudi Arabia, was distributing money to maintain his own group of people. So Osama was brought in the fold, and he was used. He was used in the way that a whole bunch of Libyan terrorists were in Afghanistan against the Russians, and these guys cannot go back because Gaddafi would get has nothing to do with them, and so they recruited them, and Osama through his network got them to at least. With the help of the British, or the British rather, masterminding the whole thing, tried to eliminate Gaddafi. When that didn't happen, that didn't fail, the British held on to their asset, and later, in 2011 and all that, they then pumped them back in order to, when they got much larger support, in fact, whole Western world support, to get rid of Gaddafi, they brought them in. Now, These terrorists, they're mostly that were created in Afghanistan, large part of their funding, British never funded them. British always laid down the policy, laid down the design, structured the plots. But money was always coming from Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is one of the, Saudi Arabia is definitely the largest donor in this whole business. And so were the Kuwaitis and to a certain extent Qataris and others. Now this, but there was an angle to it. This angle was that House of Saud always wanted that their religion, their form of Sunni religion, Wahhabi, a small sect compared to the overall Sunni population, must be, will be pushed to get control of the Sunni world. And so therefore, these terrorists were mostly were indoctrinated with Wahhabi form of religion, Sunni Orthodox religion. And after the Soviet Union collapsed, a large number of them were pushed into Central Asia, in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan in particular, for these four states, for newly formed nations. And now they are extremely poor, these countries, and the Saudi money and Saudis, you know, used to publish print Quran in Pakistan, and then Pakistan even today has a air service to Dushanbe and Tashkent, Tashkent in particular, and they used to take, you know, crate full of Qurans, the Saudi version of Quran, to these areas and distribute them. They opened up free food centers, and they recruited them simply like, you know, evangelist missionaries do in many of these poor countries. And but at the same time, out of those evangelist missionaries, there were also people, terrorists, who were recruiting. Recruiting people there who were, of course, because of poverty, were disgruntled, and they were then organized as a terrorist group. As there are two or three terrorist groups in Central Asia, big ones, whose objective was to unseat all the Central Asian heads of state who were previously were part of Soviet Union, and they were extremely secular. They have very little religious connection, and they were not 100% communist, but nonetheless they were very secular in their outlook. So in Central Asia, it was entirely run top down by the Saudi money and the British operation. The British interest was that it was very clear, I think, even at the time the Soviet Union collapsed, that the financial system is going down the drain. There is no way this financial system can be kept alive. To extend this financial system, there were a couple of things they did. One was this drug was one of the major source of money that was created through the Afghan war. And then the second thing was, of course, the old colonial interest to grab the resources came into fore. And in Libya, if you look at the Libyan oil, was Chinese were investing quite heavily in the Libyan oil. And the Libyan, the invasion of Libya uprooted the Chinese base from there. So China lost about $2 to $3 billion there. The Afghan war, the end of Afghan war, possibly will also result in the same way, that they will try to make a grab for the Central Asian oil and gas so that it cannot go northward or towards Russia, but it travels southward and possibly towards Europe and all that. This is the plans, the Southern Corridor. So there is an element of resource grabbing. The old colonial interest exists there. Now, the 9/11, basically what it did, 9/11 was organized in such a way that the American geopolitical interest after Soviet Union was gone was completely got enmeshed with the British geopolitical interest, which was primarily run in Arabia by these Saudis and a few others, Emirates and Qataris and all that, So this is now this thing is now has taken the form of this, what do you call, Arab Spring or whatever it is, basically to create total chaos and chaos in Arabia, which has all the potential to break into a full-fledged global thermonuclear war. And one added element to that is that Iran, the country who is outside of all this, is being considered as the number one enemy by all these forces, including US, UK, and House of Saud. So this Iran element is another element which has created this threat of a global thermonuclear war, that you have, well, the Soviet Union is gone, but there exists another dangerous enemy, which is Iran. Now, House of Saud is Saudi Arabia's operation, and I have followed closely in the Indian subcontinent and beyond Indian subcontinent, is basically is to undermine the existing Muslim population over there. In India and in Pakistan, even today, you know, despite all the things that you hear about Pakistan, about 60 to 65% of Muslims, which is the Pakistani citizen, they are Sunnis, but they are a very moderate variety, and it is a variety, they are called the Barelvis. They were born in a place called Bareilly, which is part of India, and even I think even 20 to 25% of the Muslims are Sunni of the Orthodox variety. Very few are, and they are Deobandis, which is pretty close to the Wahhabi variety, but not quite. And then there are 10 or 15% Shias exist in Pakistan. Now, House of Saud's operation to control these areas is that, you know, how to is first the terrorists that were created in Afghanistan were indoctrinated with the Wahhabi version of religion, and so they went after undermining the Barelvi faction within Pakistan, threatening them, killing them, and all that. It is as Hussein Ashkari pointed out, that this is, you know, it's not a Sunni-Shia stuff. Sunnis kill each other. Wahhabis kill anybody and everybody. And in fact, one of my articles, I pointed out that one of the things that Abdul Wahhab had pointed out to the British, that the uniqueness of Wahhabis is that they kill them all. They don't have any discrimination. They don't make any discrimination, whether it's a Jew or a Christian or a Shia or a Sunni, whatever it is, they kill them all. So that is the Wahhabi version that that House of Saud promotes, and they promote it throughout wherever the Muslims exist, even in places like Sri Lanka. And what is unfortunate thing in this is that that House of Saud's version of Islam is promoted by the people who are considered considered as Christians. They are considered as Democrats, like in the British. Even the Americans, in the recent years, I've seen in Sri Lanka, the Muslim minority that exists was pretty moderate. But there was the fear, quote-unquote, there was the fear of the Americans that these Iranians will have an impact on those Muslims. So before such a thing could happen, they brought in the Wahhabis. Now, House of Saud is now pumping in enormous amount of money to create these schools, which are that schools for the young ones, to teach them their version of the extreme orthodox variety of Islam. So madrasas, these are called madrasas. These have been set up in Sri Lanka. You see, this was also the foundation on which the Pakistan's extremism in Pakistan was created. They were created, these madrasas were the basic source from which in late 1990s, the Taliban forces in Afghanistan was born. This force was born right there in the madrasa. These people were indoctrinated with this ideology, and then they were sent to Afghanistan. They are young ones, sent to Afghanistan with the help of the Pakistan military at the time to take control of Afghanistan, which had many varieties of Sunnis and non-Sunnis, but more importantly, they were not, they didn't want Afghanistan to be a religious nation. They wanted Afghanistan to be just like Afghanistan of the good old days. But this Taliban took over, and it was the Saudi money, and Saudi money also to the Pakistan military, which always needed money, and the madrasas that they created, these three forces together created the Taliban. And the basic concept of this Taliban is that this is again like creating a House of Saud outpost in the belly of the threshold of Soviet Union, Russia, and next door to Central Asia, and in the belly of Indian subcontinent, from where everything can be spread and can threaten Iran, which is south and west of Afghanistan. So this is a project. This is a project that is washed with blood, but at the same time, it has all the basic ingredients which can lead to war. But again, the funding of this thing is not entirely done from the Saudi oil money, but also enormous amount of money is being generated through drug, which then gets laundered through offshore banks, which are 90% of these offshore banks at former British colonies, and it all ends up in City of London and Wall Street. So basically, what you are saying is a House of Saud's role with the British Empire, which has been endorsed by the Bush-Cheney crowd, and is now being officially taken forward by the Obama administration. That's what they're doing in pushing this Libya thing and the Syria Libya thing, and then the Syria stuff. And eventually, you never know how wide-ranging this conflict can be. I mean, Lebanon is on the verge of collapse at this point in time. Jordan is teetering on the brink, and so is Kuwait. Now, these are, these are monarchies. Then the two of them are monarchies, and these monarchies, of course, will collapse of that. One may think is not a very bad thing to happen, but on the other hand, it will be because the people who are removing the monarchies are also being controlled by the South and the British Empire. So therefore, the danger that we see to the world is increasing with all these threats. Having said that, I must also point out that House of Saud is also in great trouble. Great trouble in the sense it was never stable to begin with. But the basic Abdulaziz's the seven sons, who are known as the Sudairi Seven, they are now finishing up. The last one that exists is Salman, who is, I think, is crown prince, who I think is suffering from terminal disease, and King Abdullah, who is not one of the Sudairis, but had, you know, had to make peace with the Sudairis. All of them is under the Sudairi Seven's control all the time. Is 94, and he's most of the time he spends in ICU. Now this is going, and when it's gone, then the next generation will come in, and the next generation will have a number of very, very militant ones who will try to fight for the Saudi throne. But at the same time, this will be a fight in which there will be no public support. Public support, people in Saudi Arabia in general are deeply angered by this role of the House of Saud. Not only, not so much what they do outside, but inside Saudi Arabia itself. So basically what we see here is that a dangerous force is dangerous force like House of Saud, with British controlling the thing, has brought about a total disaster to the entire world and bringing it to the threat of another global war, but this time it could be a thermonuclear war. So this is the story of the two kingdoms. This is what they have done. Unfortunately, the American Republic has compromised, and Obama administration in particular, and Bush and Cheney, and then Obama administration in particular, have completely joined hands with these two vicious kingdoms, who are involved only in bloodshed and in creating chaos in order to loot and plunder and bring the war and keep the world on the brink of another war.
Well, you go right ahead. I was just going to ask you, Hussein, the time is fleeting, and also on the intervention side, which again, we have the election.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
And that's what I want you to speak about. Thank you.
No, because of all what has been said, I think the investigation of 9/11, 2001, 9/11, the first event, could be the drop which could get the bucket to overflow of the British Empire and the Anglo-Saudi Empire.
Uh-huh.
Because there you have, in the classified 28 pages, you have the whole story of the BAE, the British Aerospace Systems, which is now the world's largest arms and intelligence company, which is the core, I guess, besides the financial city of London, is the real core of the British Empire and the Anglo-Saudi Empire. And therefore, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration are so desperate to keep the truth about the BAE Prince Bandar bin Sultan involvement in the first 9/11 events. It's so important. And that's where I think we hope that people in the United States will pull the carpet under the feet of these imperialists, and whether getting rid of Obama or whoever comes after Obama, that the truth about the 9/11 story should come out, but not in the sense of, you know, who did what immediately there, but the whole story, because that can then bring this whole historical background we discussed into the fore and show which are the forces which humanity have to get rid of to have a better future. And of course then the other step is to get a new economic world order, to get a new financial and banking system, getting the Glass-Steagall Banking Act into place, getting credit to infrastructure, economic development nationally and internationally, and people in Asia, in Russia, China, and Africa, they are all ready to go ahead with a global Marshall Plan or New Deal. And that will help us get rid of this religious fanaticism. Now, just to briefly so demystify this whole thing, what the Wahhabi sect cult is, their teachings are. The whole thing is it's not a new phenomenon. We had, this was a reaction to the Islamic Renaissance of this the 8th and 9th century, mm-hmm. which was a real Renaissance movement and established a fantastic economic, cultural, scientific basis for civilization in Baghdad and also in Spain. And the attack came from within the Islamic world, but also part of a political conflict in the 10th and 11th century, where the Seljuk Turks, who were military officers incorporated in the Islamic armies, in order to take over, they had to destroy this whole idea of the Renaissance, which is based on two very important aspects of Islamic religion and all other religions, which is the whole conflict is about, one, free will of the individual, and second, creativity. Is the human being, does we have free will in doing what we need to do and be creative and, you know, what is said in Islam, that we help build the world, earth, we make it, we make the earth flourish. Do we have free will, or everything is decided by the will of God, which is already everything is predestined? And do the creative human being have any connection to the Creator, or is the individual human being and the world totally separated from God, the Creator? Now, in the Islamic Renaissance, these ideas were being explored. And people like Al-Farabi and Ibn Sina and Ar-Razi, they were arguing in the sense that human beings do have free will to do the good, and they are creative, and they participate in the creativity of our Creator by their act of creativity and free will, by building the world and getting scientific knowledge and ennobling the human soul through culture, music, poetry, art, and so on and so forth, architecture. That was the basis of the Islamic Renaissance, which created a fantastic culture in the Middle East, all over Eurasia and in Spain. That was the basis of the whole thing. So you had this reaction with people from, started with Al-Ash'ari and Al-Ghazali, who negated all these principles of free will and creativity and the connection to the Creator. And then you had Ibn Taymiyyah coming after the Mongols destroyed Baghdad, and then the Crusades, which were a Venetian operation. And then Ibn Taymiyyah, who is the source of the Wahhabi doctrine, he abolished all previous Islamic doctrines, including the Sunni four main, the main four Sunni sects. The Maliki, Hanafi, Shafi'i, and Hanbali, most Muslims in the world follow one of these four, the Sunnis. And then you have the Shia, who have lived actually in coexistence with the Sunnis. But they abolish all these previous ones, and they say we will have a pure theology, which is based solely on the word in the Quran and imitating some of the what they select, the people they select who were around the Prophet Muhammad. God's blessings be upon him. So they are very, very selective in choosing the prophet's tradition and the word of Quran, which is interpreted literally. There is no room for interpretation. And that way, this whole Wahhabi thing came a tool to declare everyone who is not following their military force or political force as a heretic.
This is shutting down the ijtihad.
Exactly, that you can have a free way of interpreting the word of the Quran or the tradition of the Prophet, and that because that way religion become an evolving, developing way of thinking rather than being a rigid, fixed set of rules which cannot change, and that's the core of the Wahhabi. Therefore, they come in conflict with everyone, everyone around them. So the trick is that the Wahhabis today, or the Saud, al-Saud family, who are not religious, they even ended up killing some of the Wahhabis.
Sure.
In 1930, because the Wahhabi religious and militants, they were not happy with the Al-Saud.
They're as Christian as House of Windsor is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But the power lies in their connection to the British Empire and the enormous financial and military resources they can have, and also intelligence operations. So that's where the danger is. But as I said, from inside the United States, if we can get the truth about the 9/11 and the cover-up, then you can start exploring this whole story backward into that the reality, the ones who attacked the United States Republic were the British Empire and their Saudi puppets. And that will set the world stage into abolishing empire and reestablishing a community of sovereign nation states working together to develop societies, the human individual, and the whole planet, and beyond the planet.
It will also, again, give a potential for starting a new Islamic Renaissance.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Well, with that, I think it's a call to action on the basis you just said, the highest level. And I'm going to end with the phone number again. I'm asking people who listen later or are live now. We went over just a bit. Call 800-278-3135. Of course, order online, LaRouche Pub online, or 800-278-3135 for the new report on Obama's war on America, 9/11-2, and we're going to stop it. And I thank Hussein Askari very much and Rotanu Maitra for these in-depth briefings.
Thank you, too.
Thank you. This is the end of the October 20, 2012 LaRouche Show. Thank you.
Bye.